Support for the Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the Morning Show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Over the course of the many years I've hosted WGTD's Morning Show, I've been honored to speak with five different astronauts, including Buzz Aldrin, the second man to walk on the moon, as well as Racine's own Laurel Clark. Most recently, I was privileged to speak with NASA astronaut John Harrington, who holds the special distinction of being the first Native American in space. Dr. Harrington is going to be speaking at Carthage College tomorrow night at 7 p.m. in the Todd Weir Center, a talk which is free and open to the public. It's the culminating event in a series of rocket-related workshops hosted by the Wisconsin Space Grant Consortium. On the campus of Carthage right now, 85 Native American students from 15 different schools in 11 states are gathering for the First Nations launch. And as a matter of fact, tomorrow they will be launching their rockets beginning at 8 in the morning until 3 o'clock in the afternoon out at the Bong State Recreational Area in Kansasville. And the public is invited to come and watch. And you are invited to come hear Dr. Harrington speak as well. You're asked to go to carthage.edu and find the story about Dr. Harrington on the bridge and register your interest in coming so you can reserve your seat. Let's listen to Dr. Harrington describe his earliest days at NASA, where he began work in 1996.
For about the first year to year and a half, you actually spend time in the classroom. We learn systems on the shuttle. We learn systems on the space station. You get a ground job. So not only are you learning about being an astronaut, but you're supporting the other astronauts that are flying. And your job is to support pretty much everything else from an astronaut perspective or an operational perspective for the astronaut office. And I worked for Guidance Nav and Control, was my first job in the office, and I worked with the folks, the engineers, that dealt with all the inertial navigation systems, the global positioning systems. That was my background and my master's degree, so I was able to carry forward my education, my master's, into my job as an astronaut.
So there are some astronaut candidates who probably never do graduate to the next level and become full-fledged bona fide astronauts, but you obviously did.
Well, I don't know, and often every class, you know, people complete the program for being an astronaut candidate, and they actually have a little ceremony and they give you a little silver shooting star lapel pin. When you fly in space, you get a lapel pin that's gold. That is the design that was a shooting star designed by the Mercury astronauts as the astronaut symbol. And so as a naval aviator, I get that same shooting star on the wings of my naval aviator wings of gold, once I fly. I think in my class, just a couple folks didn't get a chance to fly for a variety of reasons, medical reasons. But I think it's very, very rare that someone does not fly.
Right. So you ended up being part of the crew of the Endeavour in the 16th shuttle mission to the International Space Station. First of all, describe what the crew of the space shuttle is, how it is typically comprised. How many people were we talking about? And did you have a very specific role in that particular mission to the space station?
Yes, sir. A normal crew consists of seven people. On our crew, though, there were four main crew members because we had to take three people to space and bring three people back. And we also performed a major assembly on the space station. So I had the best job in the office. I had a chance to fly in the front seat of the T-38, maintain my flight time, but I was also on the flight deck of the space shuttle as a flight engineer, a mission specialist, and that was also allowed me to train to walk in space. And so I rode up uphill and came downhill on the flight deck as an MS-2, mission specialist 2, and then performed three spacewalks once I got to the space station. And I couldn't have asked for. I did everything on the mission I flew that I would ever have done as an astronaut.
Hmm. In other words, it involved just about every aspect of being an astronaut.
Very much.
Wow.
Very much. So transferring cargo and doing science experiments and medical experiments, and then going outside the vehicle for 20 hours and turning the wrench, essentially.
What was it? I mean, I suppose it's a little hard to describe, but what were you doing on those spacewalks? It sounds like it was not just for the sake of the view, but you were actually doing work on those spacewalks.
Oh, a lot of work. For about every hour of spacewalk, actual spacewalk, you train anywhere from 7 to 10 hours in a pool at the Johnson Space outside the Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas. And once you get out, you're essentially, I like to say, it's a high altitude iron worker. I mean, I have the technical skills and the education, but the work that I did outside the vehicle was turning the wrench. I had a battery operated power tool. I had a torque wrench. I had a standard ratchet. I was removing and connecting ammonia lines, removing launch locks. I climbed all over one part of the space station and essentially used my power tools.
Wow. What is the real thing like compared to the simulations and training that came before? I mean, can they possibly equip you to experience something, or is it an entirely different experience to actually be doing the spacewalk, just in terms of what it feels like?
Sure. When you train in the pool, you're neutrally buoyant, and you're in the suit, and the suit weighs 300 pounds. And so when they get you in the water, if they let you go, you'd sink to the bottom. So what they do is they put a bunch of foam rubber on different portions of the suit, so like around your ankles, around your different in the back of the suit and in the front, so that when you get in the water, you're neutrally buoyant. You float. Now, yourself, inside the suit, you sink. You sink into the suit because gravity is still pulling you down and the buoyancy is acting against you. So what the pool allows you to do is you learn how to translate. You learn how to go from, you know, the path you're going to take when you do your spacewalk and how to use certain tools. The problem is when somebody hands you a tool underwater, if it's a neutrally buoyant tool, it's not an actual tool. It floats. And so you get the sensation of holding the tool, but once they give you the real thing, now it's pulling you down. It maybe weighed 2 or 3 pounds, and that takes you out of your neutrally buoyant attitude. So that is not what you see in space. Once you get in space, everything's floating. Yeah, everything.
Including you.
Including you inside the suit too. So you don't actually sink down in the suit, and you actually get about an inch and a half taller in space because gravity's not, you know, squishing you down and compressing your spine. So it's much easier, I thought, much easier to work in the suit in space because there is no upside down. Now, upside down is what you see. It's not what you feel because gravity is not tugging at you in a manner that tells you that way's the ground, John, and it's what your eyes see. And so it can actually flip you upside down. Your mind can flip you from one position to the other mentally in space. And that's one of those OG whiz moments where you go, oh, wow, that's really cool.
That's neat. Tell us what it's like on the space station itself. I mean, how large is the space station and what's there and what it feels like to be there?
Sure. The space station at the time I was there was probably about the inside volume of maybe a 3-bedroom house. There was a couple Russian segments. There was U.S. segment laboratory and a connecting node. And so what we would dock to one end of the space station, and then we would enter and then float through the laboratory and then go down to the Russian segment. And right before the Russian segment, there was an airlock just off to the right side of space station. And so that's where we performed our spacewalks. We had dinner. We'd go to the Russian side, go back to the service module. We gather around the table there and have dinner at that end. But all the spacewalks were conducted outside of the space station airlock with the shuttle docked to the front. So I would climb out of the airlock and then move to the front of the space station and translate down this large truss. But that was back in 2002. Now it's probably the size of a 5-bedroom house in volume. Many more components, but you're not just using the floor, you're using everything because you have the entire volume to work in, not just the area you're standing on, because you're floating and everything is oriented which way you look.
How long did this mission take place? How long were you up in space?
Well, I was up in space just shy of 2 weeks. We had docked to the space station for about a week, performed three spacewalks, one every other day, transfer a lot of cargo. And then when we undocked from the space station, we had a 45-minute window to back away and then deploy a small camera, deploy cameras, and then deploy a small satellite out of the payload bay of the shuttle. So from the time we undocked to that 45 minutes, we were scrambling to get this done and did a great job. And then getting ready to come home, there were thunderstorms. They predicted weather, bad weather in Florida. And so they waved us off our first deorbit attempt. And I looked down and I could see the runway as we flew over. But I could look back to Mississippi and Louisiana and realize that we weren't coming home for a few days because the weather was so bad. So I had a three-day vacation in space waiting to come home. And I had it. First time I could look out the window for pleasure and take a picture out the window for pleasure. It was a remarkable experience.
Mm-hmm. How conscious were you at the time about being the first Native American in space? I mean, in the moment, was that a big deal to you personally, or was that a bigger deal to others?
Oh, yes, sir, very much so. When I didn't realize until when I came to NASA, some folks approached me early on in the program and said, "Hey, John, you know, you're Chickasaw." And I said, "Yes, I am." And they said, "Well, we have some kids coming down from a local reservation, Tiny Top Dancers, are going to come down and for a Native American Heritage Celebration. And would I be interested in talking to them?" I said, "Sure, I'd love to." And then I got involved with the ACES. I was invited to speak with the American Indian Science and Engineering Society and just shared my background and my upbringing and realized that there's this huge connection. And I was in a very unique role. And I take that role very, very seriously. And I have a lot of pride in my heritage. And be able to share what I've done in my career and the people that helped me achieve what I've achieved. I want to make that connection to other Native kids that don't realize this is something they could do if they choose to go down that path. But there was nobody growing up that I knew that was Indian, that was an astronaut. And a lot of these kids I meet, they don't realize that they could be an engineer or they could be a scientist. And if I, in my role as a first Native astronaut, I can go out there and say, "Hey, this is what you can do. This is what I did. You know, why can't you?" And give them that connection. This is what's possible, and I take great pride in that. I really enjoy the opportunity to do it.
So I understand that you have some connection with an astronaut whose name looms large here in southeastern Wisconsin, namely Laurel Clark, who
yes, sir,
came from Racine and, of course, was so highly regarded. The city of Racine was so proud of her and, of course, deeply mourned her tragic death in one of the shuttle explosions. Tell us how you came to know Laurel Clark.
Sure. No, Laurel was my classmate. We were both selected in the same class, the 16th group of astronauts. We were affectionately called the Sardines because there were so many of us. When they normally select like 10 to 15, they selected, gee, it was 35 in our class, 44 total, if you include the international folks. But Laurel was great, you know, a very, very talented lady, a great sense of humor. Her husband, John, we lived about a subdivision over, and we'd spend time at their house and just was a wonderful, fun person. Matter of fact, when they were making the selection for SDS-107, myself and two other astronauts were also in that process. We got to sit down and listen to the briefings of what they were going to do. And I looked around at the room and I thought, here's all these science folks. This is a medical mission and a lot of science stuff to it. I'm looking around going, I don't need to be on this one. This is not my area of expertise. And it's exactly what Laurel's expertise was and her background. It was an absolute tragedy when that occurred. And it struck us all, you know, really. It's hard to describe how painful that was.
Right.
But nice, you know, wonderful person and very talented in what she did.
Absolutely. I wonder when a tragedy like that occurs, how do the rest of you go on? And what does that do to you in terms of what it feels like to climb aboard a space shuttle? What does that do in terms of the way you view each and every mission?
Well, I think to do this job, you have to say, this is not going to happen to me. This is something you can't focus on, the probability of the things that can go wrong. You look at the possibility of what things can can happen from this and do well. And so we focus on the job we have to do, and don't we have to compartmentalize whatever probability that something can go wrong. You know, what happened to SGS 107 was something that, and you don't train for those type of things. And so you'd be able to say, well, it's not going to happen to me. And you value the work that's done. You value the people that do the work, the engineering. You have to rely on their expertise. There's an incredible level of trust that comes with being an astronaut. And you train for the things that can go wrong that you can train for. And realize that everybody's doing their very best to make this the safest vehicle possible. And that's what you do. And that's how you go on with it.
Astronaut John Harrington is going to be speaking at Carthage College tomorrow night at 7 p.m. The talk is free and open to the public, but you are asked to register your interest in attending so you can reserve a seat. You should go to carthage.edu, click on the link for the bridge, and find the story about Dr. Harrington's visit so you can save a seat and be sure to enjoy what promises to be a fascinating talk. My thanks to John Harrington for joining me in this portion of the morning show. And for the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show, we talk sports and we debunk some famous legends and myths in the world of sports and sports histories, courtesy of a really interesting book called Hot Hands, Draft Hype, and DiMaggio's Streak, Debunking America's Favorite Sports Myths. The author of the book, Sheldon Hirsch, who calls himself a sports geek, is someone who has not only been fascinated with sports, has played sports himself, but also been really intrigued by the way in which certain events are blown radically out of proportion, or certain complex stories are boiled down into very oversimplistic generalizations, tidying up some of the messier realities about, for instance, the teams we follow or the athletes that we venerate. And frankly, he's had enough of it and vents his frustration and offers some clarification in this really interesting new book in which he talks about some of the legends and myths and so on that have sprung up and are scarcely given a second glance. But he really wants us to think about some of this more carefully. And but don't mistake this description. This is not a dry, uninteresting book. This book is entertaining, start to finish. And even if at the end one ends up learning a lot about some of the assumptions and misassumptions that we have made about some of the most famous stories in sports. Again, the book is called Hot Hands, Draft Hype, and DiMaggio's Streak, Debunking America's Favorite Sports Myths, published by 4Edge. And Sheldon Hirsch, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you having me.
And it's good to be talking to someone who makes their home not too far away. You now live in Wilmette, but you call yourself still a New York Yankees fan.
Yes, yes. We're almost neighbors.
Right. You talk in the introduction about your love of sports beginning when you were just 7 years old. What was going on when you were seven that ignited your interest in sports?
Well, my dad was a sports fanatic. He was a calculus professor, a statistician, and a Yankee fan going back to Babe Ruth. I grew up with a slide rule and box scores. We learned that you wake up in the morning, you read all the box scores, never miss one. And I've actually done that ever since. The early 60s in New York, where I grew up, was an amazing time for sports. The Yankees were in the World Series every year. The football Giants were in the championship game, 1961 to 1963, 3 years running. And even at the end of the decade, the Knicks, who were historically a terrible team, won the NBA championship. And there was great stuff going on there. My first sports memory actually is the 1962 World Series, which in one of the least remembered incredible events ended with a tying run on third base, two outs in the ninth inning of Game 7. and Willie McCovey of the Giants hitting a line drive about 100 miles or more an hour that just happened to go right at Yankee second baseman Bobby Richardson rather than a foot above his head or a foot to the side. So the Yankees won the World Series. And that was an incredible way to be introduced to sports. It's the kind of thing that makes us lifelong fans.
Right. One thing that is interesting is that you talk about how your life as a doctor, as a nephrologist, and so your the way in which you have been steeped in science, at least in your professional life, has had a lot to do with the way that you think about sports beyond just, you know, kind of simple fandom. You say the academic training that I've had has influenced my thinking about sports. Tell us how.
Well, to start, I talked about my dad. My mom was a debate coach. So I grew up in a house where we were taught that having contrary opinions was fine, looking at evidence was a good thing to do, and we learned how to present our own opinions and evidence. And then as I got older, I first became a scientist. I was in molecular biology, and then eventually, as you said, became a kidney doctor. And one of the things you really learn in science, and you learn this as for a long time I wrote scientific and medical papers, is what I call a healthy skepticism. So you're taught in science and medicine that when someone makes a claim about something, your first reaction shouldn't be, okay, wow, that's great, that's certainly true, but rather, as I said, to have some skepticism, to say, okay, well, what's the evidence behind that? Is it really true? Let's examine that evidence very carefully. Let's make sure all evidence that can be brought to bear is brought to bear. Is there contrary evidence? Are there other ideas? And that's something that's drilled into you in science and medicine. So after a long time of learning that, I basically went back to my first love and maybe even my greatest love, my most longstanding love, which is of sports. And I applied my debate training and my scientific training to thinking about, as you mentioned, many of the events and athletes and deeds in sports history, and also as they evolved. A lot of the book is really current events, things that happened in the last year or two, where I sat there listening to what people were saying about them, what conventional wisdom was, and asking myself, I wouldn't say from a scientific point of view, but from a thinking that I learned in science, is this true?
And of course, that's something that maybe the typical sports fan is perhaps not inclined to do. I mean, that particular question, maybe it's a scary question, or some regard it as an irrelevant question, or just never dawns on them, but that it doesn't hurt to ask a question as basic as that, even when we're talking about something as relatively inconsequential as sports.
I think that's absolutely true. And I think we do that with things that are actually more consequential than sports. Cognitive psychologists have talked about something called the illusion of expertise. And what that means is that when people who have at least a veneer or even real expertise tell us something, we tend to just back off and accept their expertise as the be-all and end-all. When in fact experts, particularly when it comes to predictive power, are often just as wrong as anybody else.
We're speaking with Sheldon Hirsch, and we're talking about his new book, which is called Hot Hands, Draft Hype, and DiMaggio's Streak, Debunking America's Favorite Sports Myths. In just a moment, I want us to spend some time talking about the specific myth that is mentioned in your title, namely the famous 56-game hitting streak by baseball legend Joe DiMaggio. First, I want to ask you how you came up with the myths and legends that you explore in this book. Are these all matters that had already occurred to you a long time ago, but you just gathered them all up and talked about all of them in a book, or did you have a couple of them already in mind and then sort of sit down and think about, now what are some other legends or myths in sports that are worth debunking? I mean, have you been walking around sort of frustrated by all of these legends all of these years?
Well, I think I have had other things to do.
Right.
But I think it's all of the above. So some of these things have been ideas that I've had in the back of my mind for a long time. For example, the DiMaggio exaltation has nagged at me for a while. Then I sat down as the book kind of developed and thought, well, what other things like are there? And then the third part of that is, as I think I just mentioned, as I was writing the book, things happen in the world of sports that were given certain interpretations or conventional wisdoms or didactic evaluations. And as I sat there and thought about it, I said, geez, that really isn't true. Now, obviously, there are things that are said about sports events that are true. But this book took the things that I found were questionable and put them together into one book.
So let's talk about this winning streak that leads off the book, namely the 56-game hitting streak of Joe DiMaggio. That is, he managed to get a hit in 56 consecutive games. And as you quite rightly say, this tends to be remembered in the same breath as Wilt Chamberlain scoring 100 points in a single game, or Bob Beamon shattering the broad jump record at the Mexico City Olympics in 1968, or 92 goals in one season by Wayne Gretzky. We think of Joe DiMaggio's 56-game hitting streak in the same way. You suggest that while this was indeed impressive, this achievement does not deserve to be thought of in quite such grandiose terms. Explain mathematically what people are missing when they think about this hitting streak.
Okay, so let me first stress, as you said, that by conventional measures, this certainly was a great feat of hitting. DiMaggio hit .408 with 15 home runs over the 56 games, and there's no denying that. But the question is, why have we almost histrionically elevated this to an epic deed? Many people call it the greatest achievement in baseball history, or worse yet, from my perspective, the greatest achievement in all of sports. And in particular, we should note that there have been several 56-game sequences by other baseball players that were clearly superior to DiMaggio's. For example, George Brett, Rogers Hornsby, and Ted Williams all hit between .440 and .480 over 56-game sequences. And best of all, this is really interesting, I think, over the exact same time period that DiMaggio had his 56-game hitting streak, he wasn't even the best hitter in baseball. Over that exact same period, Ted Williams hit higher with a much higher on-base plus slugging percentage. So the question arises, why do we do this, or how do we elevate DiMaggio's streak above these other sequences that by traditional measures seem superior? And there are several aspects to the argument that people make, but let me concentrate on the what I think is the most important, which and certainly the most fundamental, which is the idea that DiMaggio's streak alone was consecutive, that the other streaks were not. So now we have to ask ourselves, what is it about consecutive that elevates something, and how does that apply to the DiMaggio streak? Well, in theory, consecutive nature could be a very beneficial thing. I'll give one example. If a baseball team gets 9 hits in a game, 1 hit in an inning, they may get 0 runs and lose the game. On the other hand, if those 9 hits are consecutive in one inning, they will score 6, 7, 8 runs. And that's an instance where the items that are consecutive relate to each other enhance each other, and the whole is far greater than the sum of the parts. However, that does not apply to DiMaggio's streak. The games were consecutive, but the hits, the items of interest, were not. It's kind of a tortured definition of consecutiveness in which the items that are important are not consecutive and are not related to each other. The hits are separated by 5, 6, 7 at-bats. And to give one example of the significance of that, if DiMaggio had not gotten a hit in his 27th game and had hitting streaks of 27 and 28, from the Yankees' perspective, that would have been 99.9% as good as what he actually did.
In terms of the difference it made to the team.
In terms of difference it made to the team. It would have been one less hit in 223 at-bats. Nobody would have noticed one less hit, except by virtue of getting that one nearly irrelevant hit in the 27th game, the streak got transformed from something we wouldn't have noticed and never would have remembered to the great feat of all time.
Right. The other point that that can be made here is that Joe DiMaggio could have had 20 more hits than he did in that season. But if there had been one game where he didn't hit anything at all, then, of course, this streak would not exist at all. So, you know, in kind of both directions, one can mathematically think about, in a sense, the artificiality of this record, for as impressive as it is. And one has a sense of actually how little it says, or the fact that it says a lot less about the difference he made to this team than, in fact, he did.
Yes, if he had not only not gotten a hit in the 27th game, but gotten two more hits in the 28th game, that would have helped the Yankees more than getting a hit in the 27th game and now having this sort of what really is a statistical idiosyncrasy more than a benefit to the team, the idea that he hit in every game.
Hmm. As you say at one point, this is a matter of baseball treating zero as hugely different from one, treating that as a bigger difference than in fact it is.
Yeah, and that's something that comprises the nature of streaks, and I think it is exaggerating the importance of zero. So I'll give you another example of that. Perfect games are basically another form of a consecutive streak. It's getting 27 batters out in a row. And when a pitcher pitches a perfect game, we exalt that, and properly so. You can't possibly do better. But I would keep in mind that getting 26 out of 27 batters, a one-hitter, is 99% as good as a perfect game. Yet we don't remember one-hitters. We don't. They're yesterday's news by tomorrow, and that's kind of an exaggeration of the difference between zero and one.
Right, and of course the point here is that we end up focused too much on things that ultimately don't make a real difference as much as we think we do. I mean, in a sense, it proves to be an entertaining and amusing distraction, but it's a distraction that, in a sense, keeps us from missing what's really going on and what really matters the most when it comes to a team winning or losing.
I think that's true. And I think one of the reasons why we love streaks, like hitting streaks or perfect games, is the melodrama. There's kind of a drumbeat. Every day, did DiMaggio get a hit? Did he not get a hit? And that lasts over the 2 months of the streak. Every batter, is the perfect game still going? Has the perfect game been broken up? Now, by the way, I think that's great. I mean, one of the reasons we love sports is because of the drama. So the drama of a hitting streak, somebody is up to, 27 games, 28 games, 29 games. He's getting closer to DiMaggio's streak. That's fantastic. That's greatly enjoyable. But we shouldn't confuse that with, or we shouldn't hyperbolize the value of the streak just because it's so enjoyable and so dramatic.
Right. And, of course, we have to be on guard for the fact that it is in the interest of people who write for newspapers and people who put together television sportscasts to hype these very things that we're talking about. I mean, it is in their interest to make these sorts of things a bigger deal than in fact they should be.
Yeah, I agree. And sometimes, by the way, and I'll say something that may be really controversial, our fixation with zero and with streaks can be harmful. So think about this. Cal Ripken very famously played in 2,600-something games in a row. And by all means, great kudos to Cal Ripken. I mean, that was a feat of stamina, of strength of will, of physical strength. Fantastic. But to keep that streak going, he clearly played in games when he was exhausted, when he was injured, when if he didn't have the streak going, he would have sat out. So he played in games he otherwise would not have played in just to keep the streak going. And you could easily make the argument that if Cal Ripken had sat out even three games in the 2,600 games, he would have come back stronger and helped the Orioles more than he did. And if he had sat out three games, the difference between 2,597 games and 2,600 games is zero. It's infinitesimal. It's irrelevant. Yet we would never have remembered it because it didn't comprise a consecutive streak.
Hmm. I want to ask you about a different matter that is also part of this first section of the book in which you focus on the sport of baseball. It's where you talk about our propensity not only to create heroes like Joe DiMaggio, even if sometimes we do so by fixating on certain things that maybe don't fully merit that sort of fixation, but we also like to create goats. And I think you really do a great job of helping us understand why we are inclined to create goats. And one of the best examples I think you share about this is with the unfortunate moment in the career of Bill Buckner. And so, first of all, remind our listeners, I remember seeing this on TV, but remind our listeners who either didn't see it or have forgotten what happened to him in the 1986 World Series, and then why you think it is the inclination of so many fans to treat this error on the field the way they do.
Okay, so it's the 86, the ninth inning of the 1986 World Series, the Boston Red Sox and the New York Mets. And the Red Sox, remember, have not won a World Series since 68 years. And the Red Sox are up in the ninth inning. And to make a long story short, Mookie Wilson of the Mets hits a routine ground ball to first baseman Bill Buckner, who doesn't bend over. The ball goes through his legs into right field. The Mets score the tying run. They go on to win the game in extra innings, and then they go on to win the seventh game. So the Red Sox streak of not winning a World Series stays existing even beyond 68 years. And Bill Buckner got blamed for losing the World Series. In fact, worse than that, he got vilified. He became persona non grata in Boston, including death threats, to the point where eventually he had to flee New England, and he ended up moving to Utah. And the one good part about this is that it was such a fixation on Bill Buckner as the GOAT that Jerry Seinfeld made an episode about it, basically caricaturizing New England fans and rehabbing Bill Buckner in one of the funniest Seinfeld episodes ever. for those who were fans of that show. So the question then is, was Bill Buckner really the GOAT? And if not, why did Red Sox and New England fans mischaracterize him as the GOAT? Now, it's pretty easy to argue that Buckner was not the GOAT. I mean, obviously, he did miss the ground ball, and that did cause the tying run. But the reality is the Red Sox messed up from beginning to end. There were a series of bad decisions and bad plays by multiple people that were all necessary for the Red Sox to lose. Buckner's was just one of them. So, for example, let's start off with, why was Buckner still in the game? He wasn't a good defensive player. They were ahead late in the game. Why didn't manager John McNamara remove him? Secondly, the Red Sox had the lead with two outs in the ninth inning and two strikes on several batters, and relief pitcher Calvin Schiraldi couldn't get the third out on any of them. Then Bob Stanley comes in and throws a wild pitch, which let a run score. And then they're up three runs in the seventh inning of Game 7, and Bruce Hurst can't hold the lead. Then they have the tying run on second base, and three different batters can't knock in the tying run. And here's the best one of all. Let's go back to Game 6. The Red Sox are winning. They have one of the greatest pitchers in the history of baseball, Roger Clemens, on the mound. And they take him out of the game after the seventh inning. And the manager, McNamara, says that Clemens asked out of the game because he had a blister on his fingertip. Now imagine that. You got Jack Morris pitch 10 innings in a Game 7 shutout to win a World Series. You have Curt Schilling, who pitched a playoff game for the Red Sox, bleeding from a sutured ankle tendon. And you have Roger Clemens asking out of the season-ending game, Buster. Now, you want a GOAT? That's unbelievable. Now, Clemens, by the way, in his defense, denied it. He said that McNamara pinch hit for him basically as a strategic decision. And if that's the case, McNamara's the GOAT. How do you take a Hall of Fame pitcher out of a winning game in the seventh inning, in the eighth inning of Game 6 of the World Series? So there's the bottom line is McNamara or Clemens, there's all sorts of blame to go around. The Red Sox team basically fell apart. And I think there are two reasons why Buckner got labeled the GOAT. First, Red Sox fan, it's a kind of salve. It's easier for people to blame one person than their team. Red Sox fans love their team, and for good reason. And to say that the team was great, but this one guy blew it, is a lot easier on the soul than to say the whole team fell apart.
Right. As you say, singling out Buckner for blame as with Mouch turns a multifaceted collapse into a more satisfying, simple story by explaining the losses as due to one person's failings. Red Sox and Phillies fans avoided the harsher reality that their beloved teams collectively fell apart. It's a way for us to soften the blow when something disappointing has occurred to a team that we really, really love. We find comfort in being able to pin the blame on an isolated figure who did something wrong versus a more systemic issue that led to the collapse.
Right, exactly. It's fascinating. You mentioned there the antecedent part to the Buckner story, which was the Phillies. And a really nearly identical concept happened. The 64 Phillies had a huge lead in the pennant with about 10 games left. And then, without going through all the details, their manager, Gene Mauch, made a couple of controversial moves that didn't work out, and he became the Bill Buckner of 1964. In fact, Gene Mauch's name remains an expletive in Philadelphia to this day, as the GOAT of the 1964 pennant race. But if you go back and look at that at the end of the season, game by game, which I did, it turns out that just like with the Red Sox, the Phillies completely fell apart. There were a horde of reasons why they lost. Their pitchers were injured. Their base runners were thrown out on the bases. They couldn't score runs. They made 13 or 14 errors in the last 10 games. I mean, almost everybody fell apart. Yet Gene Mauch was labeled as the goat and the reason why the Phillies lost.
I know we have to let you go pretty quick here, but in the last couple of minutes, I want you to talk quickly about something that's in your chapter devoted to basketball, and something that comes up all the time, not only in basketball, but in other sports as well, namely losses being attributed to lack of effort. And in this particular case, you're pointing to a disappointing season by the Chicago Bulls and the inclination for various sportscasters and, for that matter, officials of the team to chalk it up to just a general lack of effort by the players. And you really call this malarkey. Say a word about this, why we tend to like to talk in these terms and why it's a mistake to do so.
Well, I actually think this is a similar thing to the Gene Mauch and Bill Buckner story, where we take a complicated situation and we find a soothing single explanation. So we don't like to say that our teams are not good enough, and coaches and managers don't like to say that our teams are not good enough, that they just lost to a better team. So very commonly, when a team loses, you almost always read, and I cited a number of examples of this over a couple seasons of the Chicago Bulls, that they lost because they didn't try hard enough. It's always the other team wanted it more. They got the loose balls. They got the rebounds. We didn't bring it today. We need to try harder tomorrow. You never hear a coach in a post-game conference saying, my team tried so hard, I'm proud of them, it's just that the other team is better. There's one memorable exception in the NBA, which I remembered and included, which I thought was kind of neat, was Doug Moe, the Denver Nuggets. Doug was a kind of charismatic, shoot-from-the-hip kind of figure. And the Nuggets were meeting the L.A. Lakers at a time when the Lakers were nearly unbeatable, and the Nuggets were the eighth seed and the Lakers were the first seed. And before the series began, Mo said to the press, "We have no chance to win a single game. They're just too good." And in fact, they got swept. Now, I'm not sure his players appreciated his candor, but that stood in contradistinction to what we hear all the time, which is that our team is great, but it just didn't try hard enough. And I think that is, to use the word, malarkey. Most games are won by the better team.
That plays better.
that plays better, exactly. In fact, they may not be the better team, but they simply played better. And it wasn't necessarily because they're morally superior or character superior people. Everybody's trying hard. Some guys just play better, and that team wins.
Right. My favorite sport of tennis, one sees this all the time. And I think particularly in sports where it's one-on-one, it's very easy to fall into this kind of pattern. I mean, as though player A wanted to win Wimbledon more than player B did on the other side of the net. That never made sense to me. But I think you really take that apart very persuasively in your great book. Again, your book is called Hot Hands, Draft Hype, and DiMaggio's Streak, Debunking America's Favorite Sports Myths, published by 4Edge, and the author, Sheldon Hirsch. Sheldon Hirsch, thanks for this interesting book, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Monday on The Morning Show, I will be honored to speak with a Holocaust survivor, Estelle Glazer Laughlin, who's going to be coming to Kenosha to speak actually on Tuesday for their Holocaust Remembrance event. Monday is Holocaust Remembrance Day. On Tuesday, you'll be hearing a conversation with Dr. James Kinchin about Parkside's upcoming performances of the Brahms Requiem. On Wednesday, we'll preview for you the